OTB Gold, the very best of Off the Ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio.
This week on OTB Gold.
I have no control over my own mind. I went one stage 12 days without sleeping.
Are you a complete rookie?
You may say, why is he always talking about whites and blacks? Because everything happened to me is racial.
I was never as heavy as I was. I was 10 stone 11. And to lose that 7 pounds was torture.
OTB Gold, the very best of Off the Ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
This is OTB Sports Radio. Live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Okay, so as I'm sure you know, this Friday night, Congress will decide who will be the 40th president of the GAA. There are several candidates, as I'm sure you know. There is Jim Bulger from Carlow. There is Gerry O'Sullivan from Cork, Mick Rock from Roscommon. It would seem the front runners are Liam McCarthy from New York, Sean Moran in the Irish Times. Larry McCarthy from New York. Sean Moran writes that he's expected to do well amongst the international delegates, which number 72, by the way, the same as Leinster. But Sean Moran added that travelling delegations tend not to register full turnouts, so that remains to be seen. And then the other front runner we know is Jarlath Burns, who's in studio. You're very welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
How have you spent the last month regarding this campaign? Do you go around to each county and make your case and say, this is what I stand for, this is who I am? Or is it more of a through the media campaign? How does all this work?
It's not through the media campaign, really. There's a salutary lesson on that. I remember somebody told me at the beginning of January, which I'll tell you in a moment. It's you're going around the counties.
Have you been to every county?
I have been to 29, including Scotland, actually, which is a county, very important county in Ireland. Okay. I didn't go to Donegal because they're mandated the vote for me. Same as didn't go to Tyrone, the same, Antrim or Fermanagh and my own county. But I've sat in 29 counties.
And who do you meet when you sit?
I usually meet the county executive or maybe the county secretary, the county chair, and in some cases I have met the delegation that's going to Congress.
And is it an over a cup of coffee kind of chat or is it more formal? Is it they have a desk and they say, now, Gerlach, what are your weaknesses?
Well, I got that. I got that one night.
I presume I'm a workaholic is
I got that in Leash, and my answer was I was never all that good at shooting, you know. Right. And that Sunday we were playing Leash, and my wife went to the fella who said it and said, it's a pity I wasn't there, I could have given him a few weaknesses.
So coffee, you're a bit more formal?
No, it's the coffee, and it's a bit of general chat, and then they'll say, okay, the floor is yours. And you have to remember as well, these guys are there to meet and to do their own business, and they're sort of allowing you to come into their space, so you don't want to be sitting all night. You have to get in and get out, make your pitch very clear. And what mine is very simple, it's in three parts: who I am, what I believe, and what I would do. And I think it's important that people know that. I don't really subscribe to the whole thing of, well, you know, I'm from Ulster, so all of Ulster should vote for me. And most of the counties in Ulster contacted me and said, look, don't visit us, we're going to vote for you anyway. And I says, yeah, but sorry, I don't subscribe to it. I want to visit you because if my agenda doesn't chime with your vision for the GAA, don't vote for me. There's no point in voting for me. So it's important to think that any presidential candidate has a very clear view and a very clear vision of what he wants to do during his 3 years and how he wants the GAA to look when he's finished.
Because 3 years is not a huge amount of time. And it's funny, you know, we have spoken before, and if anyone is wondering why certain big issues don't seem to come up today, they're probably in part one of this interview. This is a two-parter, just to make that clear. And I was looking at things to ask you about for today, and then you have to sit back and go, actually, 3 years. Take about three decades to sort out some of this stuff. So what is the big thing? If we had to boil this down, if I was to talk to all these county executives that you've had a coffee with, and I said, what was your lasting memory of what Jarlath said to you? What's the big thing he wants to try and get done in just 3 years? What would they tell me?
Right. They would tell me the amateur status. That's the key thing for
me. Preserve that.
Yeah.
How endangered do you think that is?
Right, well, let's look at the amateur. It's one of our six values. GAA's six values: community, amateur status, respect, player welfare, inclusion, and volunteerism and teamwork. There are six values. So everything that the president should be involved in has to centre around the values of the GAA. Because the president is essentially there to cherish the values and to protect the values. So I'm going to start off with Éagán O'Farrell. Whenever he was president, he commissioned a report called Towards 2034. And what the GAA would look like in 2034 if we leave it as it is and we don't intervene. And the first conclusion that his team arrived at was that the county game would be semi-professional. Now, that wouldn't be shock therapy. We think that's the way it's almost logically going if we don't intervene, and we have to intervene in the next few years. Second point I would make in it is that we look at the amateur status from the wrong angle. Because, I mean, we have a son plays a county football at the moment, and his experience is more or less the same as mine, but it's different in many respects. Firstly, there is no pay for play in the GAA at the moment. I can absolutely verify that. It costs our son, Jarrett, though, significantly, and us, to get him to play. So you'd say, well, you've been a wee bit overdramatic there about amateur status. But that's not what amateur status is. Not paying players is a byproduct of why an amateur status exists. An amateur status exists to allow every player who wants to play the game at any level to play it. That doesn't exist. We know by the ESRI report that was commissioned by the GAA and the GPA that that doesn't exist. Lads are playing for 1 year, 2 years. Many of our potentially best county players are not playing it because the game, the demands of the game have moved away beyond the capacity of most of lads, or an awful lot of lads, to be able to have a long career. So, but the result that we have young lads, maybe in Silverbridge, my own club, tonight, kicking the ball up against their gable wall, hoping at some stage they're playing Croke Park for their county. And because of us, we are not really, that child might never realise that ambition.
Yes. Well, they will have to sacrifice too much in their professional and personal lives to play county football or hurling. For instance, it's funny you bring that up. So Tom Ryan, the DG, described the inter-county spend as unsustainable in the recent report. It's up 11% year on year. And I noted that the Limerick hurlers this week, they played Cork on Sunday. They drove up to Dublin on Monday. They flew out to Portugal. They will fly home this Saturday. They will play Westmeath on Sunday. Now, I don't know how much annual leave. Oh, you're a principal, actually, so it's not a concern of yours. The rest of us have actual annual leave concerns. But in terms of, like, lads with kids, in terms of people with demanding jobs, I mean, if I want to play for Limerick, don't you go away for a week to Portugal? So that ties in the spend and how it's funded. I mean, you have benefactors, who knows, but it's detracting from money which could go elsewhere. And then the demands on the youngster poking the ball against the Gable, who wants to have a successful professional career as well. Now, I would put it to you, how do you roll back on that realistically? Because I guarantee you, if I have a Limerick hurler in studio in a week, he'll say, we all wanted to do that. We want to strive to be the best we can be. Don't stop us from doing that. Don't tell Kieran McGeaney he can't be the best he wants to be.
But remember, this is an amateur game. And every sport has limits on it. Now, we've seen what has happened to Man City because of the financial fair play. They compromised
that. What can we apply to that
example?
Bear with
me on this, right? Yeah. They were fined the 30 million and banned from the Champions League. We saw what happened to Saracens, okay? So we have an amateur game that's unregulated, essentially. And the only way we can regularise it is actually if you listen to what the GPA said, and they're the bad boy in this, believe it or not, but I have met Paul Flynn, and Paul Flynn is on the same page as me in this. And Paul Flynn talks about sustainable amateurism. And that's the word that has to be the next 10 years where we have to run. And tell you what I mean by sustainable amateurism. We have to protect our amateur status because, let's look at the prize. Remember Simon Covey wrote a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Habit number one, begin with the end in mind. So what end do we want? So if I talk to county chairs, they'll say that it's costing us too much and we simply cannot sustain it. If I talk to players, they'll say it's not, we can't sustain it either. If I talk to Niall Miner, for example, from DCU, he'll say players are doing 40% too much training.
I said that here a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Everybody is saying the same thing. So there should be this surge, this tide that we all want to change. And the answer is very simple. I cannot expect, as a member of the Army Executive, to say to Kieran McGeaney, hey boy, you're going to have to train these lads less and we're going to spend less on them. Because, you know, we're going to have to play Fermanagh on Sunday and we played Westmeath. He has to be doing better than Fermanagh because it's an aggressive, competitive game. The GPA have the key here because they're the players' union. They are in charge of one of our values, that's player welfare. And I think Paul Flynn and Seamus Hickey need to stand in front of the chairs who have been complaining about this and say, right lads, from next year our players will be unavailable until the 1st of January. That's when they're going to do their first training session. As it stands, the most intensive training the players are doing are in November and December. Now you just think about that. November and December, and the first round of the championship is in May. Yeah. Right. That's point one. Point two of this new charter will be that up until the end of the league, county players will train Wednesdays and Fridays, no other night. You're immediately thinking, but they'll break that. Not if there's proper leadership. Not if we are going back to county chairs and saying, hang on, Buster, you told us you wanted to change. You told us that you wanted not to be spending as much money on this. We are providing a mechanism by which we can do this, and you are breaking this. Therefore, you've broken the amateur status. 10% of the 250,000 that Croke Park gives you is your fine.
That's a radical, radical proposal. And
I'm not finished.
Yeah, sure. But even on that point, so you think the GPA actually...
Yeah.
are one of the key vehicles to actually enforce this?
And absolutely, it's the GPA that are, they are the players' union. They are in charge of player welfare. And they also are, they are in their latest strategic report are talking about sustainable amateurs. And they're talking about contact time. Now, again, Jarrett Ogg, my son, went on Christmas morning and did 2 hours training session. He had his GPS on us. That's not the biggest thing in the world for him, because we live 2 minutes from our club. He went and did a gym session. That is no problem. It's what I call the tyranny of travel, getting into a car and driving 2 hours to train and back, when in fact your university is training that night, doing as good a training and as good a facilities. So January, February, Sigerson, Fitzgibbon. The same way as we do for the provincial champions of club, we should be saying to our counties, Sigerson and Fitzgibbon, a brilliant competition. The respect and the footprint that we have in universities is unrivaled by the other sports. Mm-hmm. We cannot insult those universities mm-hmm. anymore mm-hmm. and say, any player that's playing in that will be staying at his university and training in his university. He will not be travelling across the country. So that's January and February sorted.
Yeah.
And then until the end of the league, it has to be 2 nights a week.
And did Paul Flynn give you the impression that he wanted to go down that route?
Mm-hmm. I got the sustainable amateurism as a term that the GPA have coined. Yeah. They wouldn't be my friend, but they have to be a partner, and we have to stop looking at the GPA as the bad boy, and we have to start looking at them as part of the solution. Because mm-hmm. I think that they also understand, after this ESRI report, that we all as a GAA family have to move together in this. So, at the end of my 3 years, if I didn't have significantly lessened the amount of money that's being spent on county teams, I'll deem myself a failure in my last speech to Congress. Now, as well as that, being on the Armagh County Board, I can tell you, this time of year, it's the hardest time of year to gather money to pay travelling expenses for players, because it's coming to the end of the financial year. Mm. Your club championships are over. You don't have an income. It's cash flow is very difficult this time of year. And counties are finding it increasingly difficult. They're doing stuff like raffling houses, crazy stuff to try and get money.
And you look at the revenue coming into the organisation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, very interesting. Well, I mean, if that happened, that would be quite something. And if the GPA were on board with that, because, the last decade, 20 years and beyond, the cult of the manager looms large. Manager comes in, I'm going to do my 3-4 years here. Let's train at 6 a.m. Let's do this, let's do that. I want to be a hero and win an All-Ireland or achieve big things, and then I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Or either way, if I train nicely and play by the rules, we lose games, other teams are fitter, I'm still out of here.
Yeah.
And so the manager has so much sway.
Mm-hmm.
And you need some kind of sanction to stop a manager turning around to an impressionable 22-year-old and saying to him, listen, I need you training 4 nights a week with me. Don't mm-hmm. mind the ban. Don't mm-hmm. mind that. Because if we are in an organisation where there are under the table payments
of
to managers,
yeah.
and it's just like, that's just the way it is.
See the under the table payment managers.
Yeah.
Given the culture of the game, and I'm not going to blame anybody for this, because you talk to some people and they'll blame the county boards for this, for making these budgets available. Mm. You talk to other people that blame the county managers, because they'll say, well, some managers are getting paid, it's in their interest to do all this training. But all of that is wrong.
Mm.
This is a culture that has emerged and is incrementally getting away from us. And I remember reading a book a few years ago called Back in Control. We're not in control of this. Mm. We need to get ourselves back in control. And I don't blame the managers. The manager's job is in pursuit of excellence. I don't blame county boards for paying managers, because managers, it's a 24-hour job for a manager too. You're a social worker as well as a coach and as well as everything else. So all of these things, the prize is great, Joe. The prize is that we spend less. The prize is that we get our best 15 playing for our teams. The prize is that Sigerson and Fitzgibbon become the competitions we want to be. And the prize is that everybody who wants to play our game, the amateur status, their most precious value, is cherished. And we're not making unreasonable demands on our players.
Given the demand, the 24/7 demands almost on the managers, would you be in any way open to the possibility of taking these under-the-table payments and bringing them on the table and saying, let's be open about this. You're getting 50 grand a year to manage that county.
Well, I remember helping Pádraic Duffy and Nicky Brennan actually about maybe 8 or 9 years ago to write a document and add a paper for Central Council. We met Central Council and all the chairs of all the counties, and we provided them with three options. Option number one was that we just continue the way we are. Option number two was that we continue not paying managers, in inverted commas, but we properly control it, and we call out teams that are doing it, and we ask questions, and we go through a whole process. And the third one was, we pay managers. And we pay them through Croke Park, and as a result, we then get a certain obligation from them to do interviews and do all sorts of promotion and that. Everybody voted for number two, which was that the sanctions and all of that, but nothing changed, to be honest, because county chairs and county boards live in the real world, and they live in a world where, you know, in order to train a team requires particular skills of resilience and understanding of how a cardiovascular system works and all of that, and you don't get that free anymore. But interestingly, the best managers in Ireland and the most successful and sustained managers, Brian Cody, Jim Gavin, Mickey Hart, none of those managers were paid. They're all GAA volunteers and great GAA volunteers. So paying a manager isn't always the answer either, but some counties are just forced into it because they've no choice.
Okay. On the GPA, so at the moment the GPA and the GAA are in negotiations. The GPA received 15% of commercial revenue, so that's about 17 million as of 2018. That will go up. They have opened the possibility of getting a slice of gate receipts as well. It seems at the moment, you know, they perceive Tom Ryan to have called him the problem child, even though he didn't in his report. But I guess negotiations are ongoing. Is the relationship at the moment tetchy in a very normal way, a healthy kind of tetchy? Or are things maybe a bit more significant than that? It's hard to read where the GPA and the GAA are at currently. What's your read on it?
Well, they're negotiating a new deal, which I would imagine will be in place this year. I mean, so if I become president, you have a year of being Oichtern and Tuaithe or president-elect, and it wouldn't really impact on me, but yeah. I would have comment on it. I think operationally the GAA are excellent. You know, my son as a player will testify to that. My daughter is engaged to Dee O'Keefe, who's the Wexford hurler, and they have been excellent with Dee as well, putting them on all sorts of courses with regard to professional development, doing the thing that we expected them to do. Strategically, it has been a problem in the sense that you have this highly professional operation operating out of the GPA, butting up against, let's say, old-style chairs of county boards who feel that they're almost being bullied by the demands of the GPA and by the previous deal that was done. And I think that the answer to that probably lies in, you know, the president of the GAA, John Horan, has created this culture of meeting the county chairs. They're the people who are driving the association in the counties, and they're the people with all of the expertise. They understand what's going on. And when I met Paul Flynn, I said, Paul, you definitely have an image problem amongst the GAA. I mean, the GPA are hated, detested in the counties by all the volunteers. And I don't like that image that they have. It's not good for the association. And my advice to the GPA was, you go out and you go to attend the next meeting of county chairs. And you talk to them about the work that you do and explain to them the work that you do. And try and get a situation where we're all working in partnership. Because I don't agree with the politics of the bogeyman. That's populism. So you blame, you know, it's too easy to blame somebody and say, that person's to blame, that organisation's to blame, so if we get rid of them, eradicate them and all, that's populism. Life is far more complex than that, Joe, and we all need to work in partnership. We have devolved one of our values of player welfare to the GPA. We should work with them a wee bit better in order to try and get them to achieve that.
What influence would you have as president? Like, you know, the thing you talk about there in terms of sustainable amateurism, relationships between the GPA and GAA, I could actually see how you could get in there and have conversations and talk to Paul Flynn. Like, you know, I could see a real role there. In terms of actual control, what is the role still very much ceremonial? Like, we're being blunt about it.
Well, there's various parts. The president has one vote. The president will have one vote on Friday night for the new president of the GAA, and a Congress, he has one vote. He has to wield, though, influence. Now, an example of that is that John Horan made it clear that he wanted a second-tier competition. And he got a second-tier competition because there is a culture in the GAA. Well, if that's what the president wants, we feel that we have to win behind him because that's his vision for the association. There is. enormous respect for the office of presidency within the GAA, and I found that going round as well when I listened to the reverence that people would discuss the presidency with and the importance that they attach it. It is a highly significant role, and the ceremonial part of it is very important as well, because there is this mentality amongst the grassroots, and I mean, I'm secretary of my own club and I was chair before it, and my DNA is in Silverbridge, that I would be coming at it from a Silverbridge perspective. It's important, and people will sometimes dismiss this about the president going to a dinner dance and talking at a dinner dance. That's one of the most important things the president will do, that he will go and he will sit amongst the grassroots. Remember, Christy Cooney had a programme called Eastjacht, or Listening, whenever he was president, where he would go out on Tuesdays, Thursdays in his first year and just listen to clubs and to hear what they were saying. And he said that was one of the most useful things he did. Now, it exhausted him because he was out so much doing it. But I think the president always has to have a listening ear. And, you know, when you're at a dinner dance, remember Liam O'Neill going to our dinner dance and somebody coming over to him saying, why did you get rid of the novelty act and score? You know, that sort of thing. And he had to answer them. And that person went home happy that they were able to go up to the GAA president and ask him that question.
Sure.
And they got an answer.
Interestingly, seeing as you bring up something like the Tier 2 Championship, you're against that.
Well,
you were, certainly.
Yeah.
Do you like the current proposal?
Right. I think there's, again, a very simplistic narrative that we have to be so careful in this age of populism. So the narrative is, oh, those big people up in Croke Park want to push aside the poor, weaker counties and they don't want them playing. That is wrong. The people who voted for this were not trying to push weaker counties anywhere. They're trying to get a wee bit more football for these people during the summer. That's all. That's one of our strategic goals is providing opportunities for playing. That's all they were doing, providing extra opportunities for the like of Leitrim and Sligo and, you know, Wicklow and Waterford. The problem I have with it is it fails to consider the psychology of the county player. Now, you know, I remember when I played with Armagh and we were in Division 3, I still believed that the next year I was going to be in the final of the All-Ireland. I mean, in 1991, when we played down in the first round of the Championship and they beat us by a point, everybody leaving the Marshes that day in Newry said, neither of those teams, the pick of them, wouldn't beat Derry in the next round. Down won the All-Ireland that year.
Yeah.
So there's always that dream that you'll do it. Now, what I would say is this.
They do get their chance, though. They do get their shot.
But they get their chance. But look, the next thing then, they're in the Tier 2. And, you know, I know, like, for example, the day that we were beaten by Mayo, just as a quick anecdote, right? We left there and we stayed in Carrick and Shannon because we were going to the Leinster final the next day, Wexford against Kilkenny in the hurling. And we got a text from Charlie Oak who said, I have some like 25 messages in my WhatsApp here, people looking for me to go and play in America. Okay? So we weren't prepared for that. Now he went to Chicago for a couple of weeks and came back again. But you imagine the number of text messages there'll be on lads from Division 3, really good, talented footballers, when they come in having been beaten in the first round of the Championship, and they have a choice to either go into the Tier 2 or go to Boston or Chicago or whatever and play football. We know what they'll do. We live in the real world here. And even under the back door, a lot of fellas were leaving as well.
So it happens either way, really?
Well, it does, but not as much, because in the back door, at least, there's teams like Longford and Westmeath, and they do really well
in the qualifiers.
Qualifiers.
Is the onus then maybe to make the Tier 2 thing as tempting and appetizing as possible? And, you know, I heard Tom Ryan talking recently to John Duggan here in our station, and he was talking about trying to really, you know, as opposed to the Tommy Murphy Cup, really think about scheduling and really think about, you know, insisting on a certain quota of these Tier 2 games are on television and have a platform. And, you know, in some respects, I was kind of personally, I didn't love the sound of the Tier 2 thing either. And yet, of a Saturday evening, I would sooner watch summer football, two Division 3 teams having a really close game than Dublin squashing one of them. So maybe. I'm sort of quasi-open to it.
Fair play to you, Joe. That's a good way of looking at it, because everybody's looking at it from a very negative perspective. What I would say is, I think to go back to the psychology of the player.
Yeah.
And if there was a mechanism, think of the Joe McDonagh, right, where the winner of the Joe McDonagh gets back into the Liam McCarthy. I think if the winner of the Tier 2 got back in. And I'll tell you how I would propose that. And I suggested this at the Special Congress, and in fairness to John Horney, said, look, it probably wouldn't work into the scheduling. But what I said was that if the winner of the Tier 2 played an extra match against the team that had played the fewest games to get into the Super 8s, for example, Cork last year played Laois, Limerick and Kerry, Division 3 team, a Division 4 team, and Division 1 team, to get in Super 8s. Armagh played 5 games.
Yeah.
Played Down, Cavan, Monaghan, Mayo. We didn't even get within one game of the Super 8s. Now, Cork, when I spoke to Cork about this, Kevin O'Donovan, their secretary, said, We would love to have had as many games as Armagh last year. Because we're training and we're not getting games. Yeah. And they would love to get an extra game against a team that wins the Tier 2 to get into the Super 8s.
Well, that's a nice incentive. Maybe down the line, that's where you go.
It means then that when you get into the Tier 2, you're not going into a cul-de-sac, but you can actually get back into the main
competition. It's an avenue back.
Yeah. And it's something that we might develop because we have to understand the psychology of the player.
No, that's a fair point. Yeah, it's a fair point. Dublin funding, I mean, we talked a little about some of the populist, the word of the era issues. So, and we talked about Sky TV, we talked about different things the last time we spoke, but Dublin funding we didn't get into. So to lay out some of the figures, I'm sure you're aware of these, and then we can tease out where you are on this. The figure which really caught people's eye 2 years ago was the funding Dublin received between 2007 and 2018, which was 18 million euro. They were number one. So 18 million euro, I know figures on the radio are hard to keep in your head. Dublin, 18 million euro. In the same period, second place, Cork, 1.4 million. Then Derry, 1.3. You go down to 10th on the list, Offaly, a million. You go down to Mayo, way down on the list, 700,000. So, like, you know, Dublin have about 70 coaches. And look, the population is the population, so you need 70 coaches. But Cork, second on that list, have six. Hmm. Now, it's tempting to go, well, we need to strip back what Dublin have got, and I don't want the game to fail in Dublin. But equally, there is a discrepancy, and it happens to have fallen in advance of an era where Dublin have been completely dominant. And people understandably look at that and look at that, and there are lots of variables here, so cause and effect is a complicated thing. But I absolutely think it is a factor, and we can't just discount it. So even John Ryan has kind of said, or Tom Ryan has said, yeah, look, we're going to have to look at this. So how quickly do we look at this? Do you agree it has been wrong, for want of a better word? It has been a galling discrepancy for the other 31 counties around the country. Where are you on Dublin funding as the next president, potentially?
Well, firstly, as an Armagh man, I have no selfish or strategic interest whatsoever in Dublin GAA. Okay, that's an important point to make. But here's what I would say. Let's go back to where all of this came from. All of this came from a strategic review called by Sean McKeag in the year 2001, and I was a part of that.
Right.
Chapter one of that was Dublin. I would urge anybody who would have strong feelings in this to read that chapter. Because that chapter said, at that stage, Dublin was a basket case financially. It was not an attractive prospect corporately to try and fund it, and that the structures in Dublin were not fit for purpose. And that it said, I remember Peter Quinn, who was the author of that report, saying, if we don't do something about Dublin very quickly, we're going to lose completely the GAA in Dublin, because there's vast areas of Dublin where the GAA, they don't even know GAA exists, right? All of this comes down to whether or not you value that we should be relevant in Dublin or not. So we did. The GAA, and I was very close to a lot of decision making at that stage, and it was decided that we needed to do something about this. So they come up with the model of the half coach in the club and the other half in the school. That has been very successful. And I think the biggest success that has come out of that is with Coola winning two hurling All-Ireland titles, a club in South Dublin. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we're at the stage where we should be celebrating the success of that initiative at this stage. We should be celebrating it because there are two parts to this. First part is the GAA in Dublin, Gaelic Games promotion in Dublin, and the belief that if we're not relevant in our capital city, that's a terrible thing for association. But the second part of it is Dublin county team and its success, which I think is down to three things. Jim Gavin, brilliant manager. John Costello, brilliant CEO. And the third thing, a brilliant group of players. Now, that group of players is starting to come to an end. Like, I went to watch their under-17s on one errand in Tullamore in the quarter-final of the All-Ireland this year against Mayo, because they led in 3-12 in the Leinster final against Kildare, and I wanted to see who is the next generation. Now, out of that team, they led in 5 goals that day after extra time. I picked out two players, a guy, Luke Swan, full forward, and a guy, left half forward, a brilliant free-taker and a great playmaker, Finn Murray, two players that would possibly next year make the ban. Nobody else.
You only need one or two each year.
Yeah, but if you look at Cavan between 1940 and 1960, they won 18 out of the 20 Ulsters. And at that time, people would have, like now, maybe if there was podcast, people would be saying, oh, knock this in the head, knock Ulster Championship, it's ridiculous. I would never have won an Ulster title in 1999 if we had done that. Mm. All of these things are cyclical and will come to an end. But I'll tell you this, a lot of the metrics that are being used are wrong. Now, see those figures you brought out there? That fails to consider the fact that the amount of money that the GAA has put in elsewhere in those counties. You know, for example, we built the athletic grounds. We got maybe 7-8 million out of that. We also got $500,000 for a hurling project in our county. Look at how much Cork got for Parky Cueve out of Croke Park. And also then, though people will hate me saying this, that those millions that we get would not exist if it wasn't for what Dublin's generating for the GAA. And all of that money that's being put into Dublin, some people will say per member, Dublin's getting far more, but that's not what this is about. This is about putting a slither and a hurley stick in every child in Dublin's hand.
Sure.
So at some stage they can say, I played Gaelic football or hurling. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember in 1995, Dublin won the All-Ireland, and we went, I think they beat Tyrone in it, right?
Yeah.
And we went to that match and we stayed in the Gresham Hotel, myself and my dad and mum and the whole family. And I remember walking up O'Connell Street the morning of the All-Ireland, and the whole way up the Croke, you would not have known that Dublin was in the All-Ireland final. That has changed. The whole of Dublin is behind Dublin. I think we're still at the stage of celebrating that, Joe. Yes, we may have to tweak it in future, but if you look at the entirety of the structural funds that goes into each county, and if you add that coaching into it and add the money that we give for centres of excellence and for stadiums and other counties, there wouldn't be as big of a discrepancy as you think. But I will always hold to the fact that I want our association and I want the GAA to be relevant and significant in Dublin. Some people mightn't think that's important, but I do, and others like me do as well.
Okay, that's fair enough. People will agree and disagree on that one. Because I saw, even over in the AFL, they really pursue the equalisation model, as it's called, and pursue it in a big way, whereby they recognise that there's no point having a competition where the weakest isn't comparable to the strongest. So they're constantly trying to rebalance that. And I think it was something Paul Flynn even advocated in recent times. People just want that tone. They want to feel, see, where it gets complicated is you make a statement like you've just made, which is, well, if you add in this and you add in that and you add in this, the discrepancy isn't as bad. And I need to go off and check that and Google that, and then I have to come back and then you say something else and on we go. Right, grant. Maybe it's not as bad, but certainly there is a feeling that Dublin have more than had their fair share, and there will be a queue of counties who really feel, well, we haven't. And that's something I think people would like to see addressed in a very transparent way over the next couple of years, and everyone go, okay, fair enough, we can see how that's coming back into line, while still keeping Dublin strong. I mean, I'm with you there, I'm first with you there. If Dublin GAA goes, it's really bad for the for the whole association. So again, I don't know, is that something the president is responsible for in a hands-on way over the next 3 years?
Well, if you look, you know, one of the things that I would propose is a new strategic review of the association.
Right.
And I talked about our values, talking about our strategic goals. The GAA has 5 strategic goals. One of them is governance. Mm-hmm. The other one is providing opportunities for playing. Mm-hmm. The third one is developing our volunteers. The fourth one is communicating our message. And the fifth one is protecting the association. I think we need a sixth one. And this would have to come about after a new strategic review and a 10-year plan. You talked about 3 years, and you're right. Our strategic plan lasts 3 years, the length of a president. We have to forget about that model. All the major organisations have 10-year plans, yeah. UEFA, FIFA, RFU, all of those. Our sixth strategic goal must be addressing demographic realities.
Yes.
So there are only two counties. We all talk about rural population, but there's only two counties in Ireland where the population has actually declined. It is rising everywhere else, but it's rising to become an urban society. Now, we are not as strong in urban Ireland as we are in rural Ireland. So what I am saying is that in rural Ireland, like the Catholic Church has done with its clustering of parishes, we need to start looking at making it easier for teams to amalgamate. We need to have an amalgamation toolkit. Mm-hmm. Back in 2010, myself and a few others wrote the GAA volunteer recruitment toolkit. We need to start making it easier in places where teams are finding it hard to field an amalgamation toolkit. But also, we need to be then getting people to honour their responsibilities in the towns. There are some towns with 5 teams where they're having to amalgamate. So what I would propose is that if a team in a town has to amalgamate, you'd say, okay, I don't want to get too complicated in this, but the Talent Academy review report and the fixtures review report proposed the employment of 4 new people in the provinces. That's a sports science manager, a player pathway manager, a coach education manager, and a fixtures review manager. I would have those 4 people working also on the demographics and amalgamations, and that your application to amalgamate goes into those guys. They'll look at it and see, well, we let you amalgamate this year, but there's a lot of chimney pots in your area, according to our demographic map that we will have worked on. you should have 15, maybe, you know, you should have maybe 5 or 6 teams at this level. So I want your application to be accompanied by an action plan for how you're going to get all of those children out onto the field next year.
Right.
My club is 800 people living in it. We have 780 members. We won the minor championship last year with 17 players, 2 subs. We've taken them the whole way through from under 12. We won the Fela and we've won because we knew we didn't have anybody else.
Yeah.
We're envious of teams. If you look at Fingallians, for example, a Dublin team, they're intermediate. They have, I think, 14,000 people living in it. Now, what we should be seeing is that in areas of high population, we should be offering incentives to communities and areas to create a new club and maybe giving them 3 years of fee-free play. Because the only time you ever hear of a club being set up in the GAA is if a club splits.
Yeah.
That is not an effective model of governance. And this is a 10-year project that I think we need to do with our 6th strategic goal of addressing demographic reality, using the opportunities that exist within the towns where we are increasing and dealing with the reality of rural depopulation. We're never going to turn that tide. There's some great work being done with the Leinster Council on this, and I think we would need to build on that. In fact, there's a workshop at Congress on that whole demographics things, and I have a bit of a geeky interest in it. And the final point I'll make on it is this, Joe. Back in the early 2000s, we had the National Spatial Strategy, which I thought was a brilliant, brilliant national plan for Ireland, which created all the hub towns, all of those places like Mullingar and Kells and Kilkenny and Letterkenny that got bypasses and an awful lot of industry around them. Mm. And part of that project was going to be decentralisation of government jobs. That would have been brilliant if that had happened, but it didn't happen properly, with the result that Dublin has grown exponentially.
Yeah.
And we can't do anything about it. So we have an action plan for rural development going on while we're closing Garda stations, while we're, you know, shops are closing, ATMs are gone, post offices are gone, and all that's left is the chapel and the GAA club. Now, we need to plan for that more strategically than we are. That's why we need a 6th strategic goal and a 10-year plan.
It's funny, the line in our first chat, and we talked about strategy and we talked about all these philosophical issues, the two things which resonated with the listeners, by a distance and the comments, Sky TV, ticket prices.
that was the big heading you gave, the Burns thinks ticket prices are too high.
And good on him, said most people.
Yes.
Ticket prices.
Right. Look at the Ulster Council. I'm a member of the Ulster Council. Last year, the Ulster Council actually put its prices of tickets down. Crowds went up significantly,
yeah,
and revenue went up. You don't have to be an expert.
Agreed.
In understanding fiscal revenue too. And I think part of this, and people will hate me for saying this, mm-hmm, at the top of the GAA, the ticket prices are set in the GAA by people who don't have the pay-in.
And when I go to games in the main for work,
yeah,
don't pay.
Exactly.
So, and that's an important point. And it's funny, so when you talk about the Ulster Council's decision there, that is a good decision for them financially because revenues come up. The point we came upon when we last spoke actually was I was kind of saying to you, well, like €90 for an All-Ireland final ticket, €50 for a semi-final, the programme has gone up to like €7, the team isn't even in the programme, you pay through your nose for food and drink at Crow Park, and the argument the GAA can and do make is, well, that's not bad. If you compare that to rugby and the RFU down the road, who, by the way, fund 80% of their expenditure.
I hope you're not going to say this because we're an amateur game that we shouldn't be charging that into it.
I am about to say that, actually. And here's the point. So the RFU have to charge through the nose because they take advantage of as much money as possible because they have to pay Conor Murray and the lads' wages. So the point I would make to you is it's not bad, like €90 for an All-Ireland final ticket. The fact that you fill Crow Park suggests it's not bad. The fact that you sell programmes and they do sell for €7, it's not bad. But you know what? It's not good either. And why shouldn't the GAA strive to be excellent value for money? Why shouldn't they look at the Bundesliga, mm-hmm, say to ourselves, it's not bad, we can justify it, but actually, let's go one better. Let's be exceptional. Let's be used as an example the world over. And that's what frustrates me about the GAA. Record revenues, doing a fantastic job. The FAI a mess by comparison. And yet I look at the GAA and I think, you guys could really set a tone here. That'd be fantastic. €50 for the All-Ireland final. Okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Make a statement.
Let me talk about the All-Ireland final and the semi-final,
sure,
right? I mean, for an awful lot of instances, if you bring, and we do this, if you bring a busload to the All-Ireland semi-final, you can get children in on the Davenin for a fiver and people free if you really want. If you really want to go and if you really want to get in sure. cheaper, you can.
Yeah.
The All-Ireland final is the GAA's big payday because something like 70% of games run by Central Council run at a loss. Now, at every level, the GAA is something. The GAA at club level is, you know, part of our values and everything else. But whenever you go into the broadcasting, whenever you go into the All-Ireland final, it is a product and we have to sell that product. Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the revenues that Conor Murray has to be paid and everything else. Within the GAA, our...
Conor Murray's having a tough time at the moment. I don't want to pick on him.
It is you who say...
I know, he jumped to mind.
Our player injury scheme,
yeah.
Because it's so good, yeah. the GAA has to subsidise that to the tune of 9.5 million every year.
Fair enough.
One All-Ireland. That's one All-Ireland gone
yeah.
on that alone.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
it's not as if we're using this to paint our nails. 85.5%, I think, percent of every pound or every euro we earn goes back into the grassroots. So it's not as if the GAA doesn't have stakeholders or shareholders. We have stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference, I suppose. It's not really even the All-Ireland I'm talking about. I'm talking about generally maybe some of the prices we charge into our games are a wee bit high. Mm. Having said that, you can go and watch a club game, you know, fiver
sure.
or £4. 90% of all of our games, like all our schools' games, are all free in. Under 16's free into the National League. Like, it's not all a bad story. If you buy online, you get 20% off. You know, season tickets are a lot cheaper. And we've done away with this idea of, it used to be the narrative that, oh yeah, the poor, good fan doesn't get a ticket for the All-Ireland, yeah. all of these rich people can go.
Yeah.
If you buy a season ticket and your team gets in,
a great initiative.
Yeah. Brought in by Ronan Murphy in the ticket office when he was there, and a man I had great respect
brilliant,
for.
Has, yeah.
you know, so you have all of that. It's not all a Drogscale, Joe, but I still think that maybe we could actually bring in more money and get more people to our games if we maybe charged a wee bit less.
Okay. Listen, we're pretty much out of time. By the way, I'm not going to reopen Sky because we did a lot in part one, but...
I have to clarify one thing.
Is it going to be quick or not? Because I have to clarify one thing too.
Okay. Paul Rouse from Offaly contacted me.
Is this about the fact that GAA go in the UK?
That's it.
Yes.
I want to clarify that.
So the point is, because you said... And I let you away with it. And I knew at the back of my mind there was something saying that's not right.
It's not like you, Joe.
But he has said that with certainty. I need to check it. So basically, GAA go in the UK. Basically, in the UK before Sky came in, you got all the games at a really good price. Premier Sports, I think it was called. I'm not sure the name. Mm-hmm. I didn't live in the UK. But you paid your money. You got all the games. Brilliant. GAA go have come in. Now, you were under the impression that if you pay GAA go now, you just get all the games for the season. Mm. Whereas actually, you don't get the Sky Sports games. So in effect, you have to pay GAA go. And then you might have to pay Sky Sports as well. Mm-hmm. So just on that point alone, that it's better for, you know, the immigrant population or the expat population over there, it's not.
Okay, that is correct. However, as part of my canvas, I attended the British Convention
right.
At the beginning of January there. And I spoke to all of the counties, Warwickshire, Hertfordshire, London, Scotland, the whole, and I asked them this question. And they think it's brilliant. I didn't get one person in Britain saying, oh, this is terrible. I was in England yesterday at a funeral. The great Tadhg Meehan from Galway was Gnana Gia Troca Aranam. And I served in Central Council with Tadhg and a great respect for him and went over to his funeral. I talked to the British GAA over there again. I asked a lot of people, Conor McGinn, who I taught, he's an MP for St Helens. And I spoke to him at length about Sky. He says, Sky, it's brilliant for us. He says, we can watch it. We can watch the games. He says, we have no complaints. Mm-hmm. So the people who are accessing it have no difficulty paying for that service.
Fair enough. Well, my point still stands about the people here who are out of games, but we'll...
You can watch part one.
You can watch part one.
Please let me answer it.
They're killing me here. I literally have to go. Right. Come on. Right, quick.
The answer is this.
You'll never convince me on this.
I would love if at the next broadcast auctioning session, all our games are free to air. That's what we want. Because at the end of the day, audience share is more important. And I want 500,000 people watching our programmes and our matches than 5,000, regardless. That is very important. That is, begin with the end in mind, go back to Covey. That's the end that we want. But the Indigenous stations have to play their part in that as well. Our TV3, our Virgin, didn't come into the table at all the last time. It didn't suit RT to buy that last package of 14 games that Sky bought, so they bought it. So if Sky didn't have that, nobody would have had it. That's the reality. But I know that I may have criticised RTE the last time and said we'll not take any lectures from RTE, but RTE are a good partner and a good loyal partner to the GAA, and they're very much a part of what we are. They're the national broadcaster.
Let's not go overboard in RTE here and here.
Sorry. But as well as that, we also
they're grand.
We also have TG Car. We have to remember and the work that they do too.
Listen, so Friday is when is D-Day? Yeah.
Friday is D-Day. Okay. The election's at 7, and then we go through the first maybe 25 motions, which will probably be a blur to me, and round about after 9, the result will be known. So whatever will be, will be.
Well, I wish you and all the candidates, obviously, the best of luck. So, Charlotte Burns, thanks so much.
Cara maha gach.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.